Hello, welcome to PSR, People Speaking Rail. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Bowden-Distel, Head of Intermodal Solutions here at FreightWaves, joined by Joanna Marsh, who does editorial writing on the rail industry. And Joanna, you just published an article on the topic of the day, or topic of the hour, maybe, is the Surface Transportation Board issued a notice of proposed rulemaking. There it is. That's a good picture, too, that we got from Jim Allen. Some nice looking boxcars in front of a mesa in maybe New Mexico or Arizona.
Yeah. Well, in a way, it is kind of the story of the day, at least for rail, because it's been, you know, if you don't count the shippers that, you know, this has been before the Surface Transportation Board for over 10 years. If you don't count that, you at least count the 2016 part. So where I think they were considering it, obviously considering more seriously, but I think there was more action done during that time frame. So what was it? So 2016, math, like around 7 years. So, you know, it is the story of the day to see the Surface Transportation Board finally take some kind of action on the reciprocal switching, which they have been saying that they were going to do this fall. So here it is.
Yeah, which is why there wasn't much reaction to the stock prices. I mean, at first I was thinking this was kind of a negative for the railroads, maybe a positive for the shippers. And kind of the more I read about it and then sort of went through as much of the source material as I could, I kind of came to the opposite conclusion that maybe this is a good thing for the railroads. And we'll get into that today. It'll be a topic of our show. But for those not familiar with reciprocal switching, how would you describe that to a lay person? Like, assume you know nothing about railroads. How would you describe it to that person?
Yeah. So let's see if I can do it. I to this day, I still kind of struggle with it a little bit. I shouldn't be saying that on live, but here we are. Let's see, reciprocal switching. So you have a shipper using one class one rail carrier, and essentially they would like to continue that shipment on using the network of another class one railroad carrier. That system has actually existed in Canada and the most part for quite a bit, I think, yeah, for decades. And reciprocal switching does exist in certain areas in the U.S., agreements established, you know, long ago. But the idea of the way that shippers have pushed the idea of reciprocal switching is that it helps shippers, particularly captive shippers, so shippers who only have access to one railroad, by giving them access to another railroad, that kind of, you know, that increases competition and also can be used as a but it can be used as a way to sort of, you know, come back to your host railroad and be like, hey, look, this, you know, if I can move my shipment to this other railroad, you know, I guess rates, that's what I'm trying to come up with the word. It can help with trying to get a better rate, at least for the shipper angle. So that's essentially what it is. I'm still kind of going through this decision, which is actually a proposed, I should back up a little bit. It's actually a proposed rulemaking. So the comments are due, I think, October 23rd, around that time frame. This is exactly, you know, this is what's going to happen. So it'll be interesting to see what the shippers say and what the railroads say when the comments trickle in. And there's going to be also a response period. It's going through the formal, rulemaking process.
Yeah, so exactly. So a way to help a captive shipper, they're on one railroad. This one railroad wouldn't be the only game in town if only the second railroad could use that line to take that shipment over that line. So reciprocal switching, and a few things stand out to me about this notice of proposed rulemaking. One of them was it was a unanimous decision by all five STB board members, including the two Republicans. And then the other thing that really stands out is that this is driven by service failures. And this is kind of like, it's kind of a good news, bad news thing for the railroads. I mean, the shippers would have preferred reciprocal switching to be possible or mandated, even in cases where there was not a service failure. But in this case, it's going to be triggered. It has to be sort of triggered by not meeting certain service thresholds. And the Surface Transportation Board tried to address the issue of, you know, having standardized, you know, data sort of across the railroad, sort of using all the same metrics. So one railroad's not reporting in one manner, different railroads reporting in a different manner. So it's kind of apples to apples. Have a grid that's from that document, from the Surface Transportation Board that goes through this. So basically, in order for a particular shipment to be a candidate for the Surface Transportation Board to order reciprocal switching, one of the three criteria has to be met on the left column. Either there's a service reliability issue, a service consistency issue, or the industry spot and pull issue. And so this service reliability is sort of the first sort of benchmark. They're saying it needs to be 60% you know, on time near this estimated ETA. They talked about having that, maybe that 60% becomes 70% over time, but at least sort of 60% to sort of start with. And then the consistency, you know, has to do with, you know, not just are you, you know, not on time 60% of the time, is are there times where you're way, times when you're way late, more than 20 or 25%, you know, measured over a 12-week, you know, period. What I liked about that service consistency component is that they're comparing it to the year ago period. So there's not a lot of ability to sort of game the system, you know, which is what I wonder about with this, that first criteria, that OETA, the sort of estimated, the original estimated time of arrival. I just wonder if they sort of this possibility exists for railroads to sandbag that and maybe add in some extra cushion into their ETA in order to, you know, be more reliable. And then that third segment is something the industry has complained about for a long time, that on the shipper side is industry spot and pull. And that has to do with first mile and last mile. A lot of shippers have complained for a long time that there really is no reliable, consistent industry mile. So those are kind of the three things that the railroads are going to have to hit in order to avoid, you know, having one of these mandates. And we can go sort of dig in deeper in a couple of additional charts. Sort of that first one here is this weekly percentage of manifest service rail cars placed within 24 hours. The STB provided a different, you know, chart on that. And they showed that in, let's say, you know, mid-2022, some of those, you know, there it is, you know, some of those were below 50, below the 60%. So they're proposing that the railroads have to be, you know, 60% within 24 hours of that original ETA. And so kind of on average in 2022, the BNSF would have been subject to certain, you know, mandated reciprocal switches. So would the Norfolk Southern, whereas CSX's on-time originations, for the most part, sort of system-wide, you know, the service was good enough to avoid those metrics. You know, all of those targets are above that, those bogeys. So as long as those, you know, the STB would say, well, as long as you're meeting those targets, which seem to be reasonable, you know, you avoid the mandated reciprocal switch. And then if you know, switch over to this next chart, goes to that third criteria, the industry spot and pull. They're talking about 80% there as being kind of the bogey that they have to hit. And, you know, for the most part, you look at mid-2022, most of them were hitting those things, with the exception of Norfolk Southern. But their sort of interim target is close to that 80%. So if I'm a railroad, I may be a little bit relieved, because all of the potential mandates for reciprocal switching, there has to be some sort of service failure. What can take place is simply that the shippers are upset about the pricing of the freight service, that let's say you're a captive shipper and the railroad takes up the rates 6 or 7% this year and talks to 6 or 7% the last year, and then, you know, do that year after year. And pretty soon the rates are at a tremendously high level. You know, that would be something that's more just economic competition, but that's not being addressed here. And that's something that was left with the old proposed rules. So for me, if I'm a railroad, I'm sort of breathing a sigh of relief. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting, you know, the Association of American Railroads comment, because it wasn't, and of course, this is just inferring. So, but it didn't necessarily come out and you know, come right out and pan the proposed rule. It actually was kind of like, well, let's take a look at this and we'll see. And then, of course, you have the second paragraph, which is kind of like, well, you know, this is what, you know, kind of the stance that you would think that the industry would take in terms of, you know, the proposed rule needs to have data to back it up, essentially. So, yeah, it wasn't as negative, at least my perception of it wasn't as negative of a response as it could have been. And like you, I was actually interested in the shipper responses so far. I haven't, you know, I've heard from two shippers. I haven't, you know, I'm still need to check out, you know, the thoughts of some more people. But yeah, just the, you know, what one shipper had mentioned, you know, how it was interesting how there is that, you know, you've had all these service issues before the board, and so this proposed rulemaking, you know, is a way to address those service issues. And he thought it was actually kind of neat, because, you know, it doesn't make too, you know, distinct room. You know, you have your, it sort of combines the ongoing, you know, problem, with, you know, this question of risk. So,
It seems to me like it depends on what the shipper's biggest concerns are. And mm-hmm. if it's a shipper, like you had that quote, I think it was your article, I did read a few others too, by Herman Hackstein, who is runs the Food and Beverage Association on behalf of shippers. And that's an industry vertical that's a little bit more concerned with service. Those products have to be on shelves. And, you know, he came out positively on the proposed notice of proposed rulemaking, because it does address these service issues. Whereas there was another quote from the American Chemistry Council, and they seem pretty disappointed that they abandoned the original sort of you know, proposed rulemaking, where they would be broader than that, and that it would be designed to enhance competition. And so, if I'm in those the members of the Chemistry Council, I mean, in many cases, there's no modal alternative; it has to go on the railroad. If there's a situation where they just think the prices are too high, the rates are too high, they can't, you know, ask for solicitation of a reciprocal switch from another railroad just on the basis of the rates being too high. There has to first be a service failure. And so, in sort of thinking about this kind of game theory, is that the railroads in those cases, they know that that's kind of a captive shipper. They're going to make sure that they're just above those thresholds. And so those cases won't be considered. So it seems kind of, you know, mixed on the shipper side, you know, so far.
Yeah. I'm kind of hoping to do a follow-up on it to, you know, just to gauge, probably, you know, get some thoughts, some more thoughts from American Chemistry Council, on that. So, we'll see how that goes, and we'll see, you know, what other people, you know, as even the railroads, as you know, as people have more of an opportunity to sort of let the, let things sink in and, you know, see what it means for their, customers or membership. Let's see, between now and how was it, October 23rd. So got a good, little over a month.
Yeah. So they have a little over a month to submit these, comments. There will be a lot of comments. I can surmise what the railroads are going to say. I mean, in addition to what Ian Jeffries has already said, is they're likely to say, well, you know, if you have to, you know, basically allow another railroad to use your track, is that reduces the incentive to invest in your own network and to provide that, you know, that capital. Cause essentially, I mean, the track is the, you know, and maintenance of way is essentially the biggest capital expenditure that the railroads have. It's even more so than the equipment, and there's less incentive to do that. And you really maintain that equipment, invest in it, you know, double track, do extended passing sidings, all of those investments. If ultimately you're just gonna have to share this with another railroad, I think they'll make that point. I think they'll also really drill down into this efficiency question, where the railroads networks are so precise that all of a sudden, if another railroad has to go on, let's say railroad B has to go on railroad A's network because of a mandate, that really throws a wrench into the efficiency of railroad A. And all of a sudden, then other shippers on the original railroad are getting worse service because there's congestion that's going to be caused by the mandated reciprocal switch. So I think they'll really come hard on sort of the efficiency angle. And I think they'll also discuss that there are certain things that are outside of the railroad's control. Now, STB has already included in this notice proposed rulemaking what they call affirmative defense. And so it sounds as though anytime there's a unusual weather event, you know, hurricane, flood, polar vortex, et cetera, that the railroad, that data will be excluded from what's being looked at, and that won't be counted as a service failure because it's essentially mitigating circumstances. I think the railroads would say, well, you know, there's not only those things, but the volumes on the railroad can be so volatile that it can be difficult when there's a surge in demand to meet all of those, meet all those service requirements. Because usually what will happen is there will be a surge in volume demand on one particular revenue segment. So let's say just to move motor vehicles or just on a particular part of the network, and there'll be congestion on just certain parts of the network. And then, you know, how do you just differentiate? Let's say, you know, Chicago is always, you know, more congested than, you know, other parts of the railroad network in most cases. So there's a lot of, I think, nuance there that the railroads will say that these rules don't take into consideration.
Yeah. So let's see. I think Mike, you had some chart sonar charts to show. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a few minutes left, and is that kind of an overview? I would encourage everyone to go and check out, you know, your article, and also some good ones on, you know, some of the other outlets. Railway Age always has a sort of a good one there, like the work they do as well. But have some sonar charts to go through. And I think, you know, the big thing for me is that the rail traffic is indicating that the industrial economy is weakened, which is probably just sort of the natural conclusion of having higher interest rates, and interest rates really rising, you know, steeply for some time. You sort of see that in the industrial production data, where you have the ISMs, you know, below 50. But you look at the sort of rail carload chart, which is the first chart I have. And you do see the, you know, the 2023 is that white line. And right now we're at about, the latest week carload. So everything excluding intermodal units, you know, down about 2% year over year after having been kind of flat to up a little bit in the beginning part of the year. And turning to the next one is, you know, major reason for that is lumber and wood carloads. And so this is exactly what you'd expect with the higher interest rates, with people stuck in their homes. You know, people who have mortgages that are 3% are not running out to buy a new house if their mortgage is going to have to be 7%. And you see this being reflected in lower volumes of new construction. So wood and lumber carloads. And we see this in the AAR data on primary forest products, which would include logs and also, you know, lumber, which go, you know, obviously into houses. But you see that's been sort of weak all year and is, you know, even weaker still. So those numbers are down, you know, double digit percentages year over year. And turning to the next couple sonar charts are ones that I think are important as well. You have one on intermodal rates from LA to Chicago. And this has been an interesting one. So we have in Sonar intermodal rates for about 100 lanes. And, you know, these are intermodal spot rates, which not that much intermodal moves on the spot market, but there's still information, I think, in this data points, and really suggests, I mean, it's been suggested in a lot of other places too, that there's not going to be much of an intermodal, you know, peak season, but this is the time of the year that, you know, normally those intermodal spot rates rise and will rise as the railroads get concerned about securing capacity for the big contracted shippers. There's really no evidence that they're concerned about securing capacity for those contracted shippers now. And really, contrary to what's typical seasonally, is they cut those rates from the LA to Chicago corridor down to $1.31. And also that's the white line, and the green line is from the LA to Dallas you know, corridor. A lot of freight moves in that lane down to $1.56. And those include fuel surcharges, and that's door to door. It's also, so it also includes the drayage, you know, portion of the network, and just really sort of reflects that, you know, the truckload market is competitive, and they're confident they're going to have enough containers for the major, you know, contractual shippers. I'll flip to the next Sonar chart, which is another one that that stands out to me. Is this is one that, you know, Henry Byers wrote a really great article about earlier in the week. I want to say it was maybe Monday or Tuesday of this week, where he talked about how, you know, his expectation is that spot rates in the ocean market are going to come down. And then what we're looking at here is ocean booking, is an ocean booking volume index. So ocean volumes on that are booked at point of origin. So the biggest, you know, point of origin is going to be China. And you see that those peaks right around July 31st, and they've fallen off, you know, rather, you know, sharply. That index was at, it was at 120, and now we're at about 80. So it really has come down, you know, significantly. That's really going to hit the volume coming into the ports of LA, Long Beach. A lot of that translates, you know, very directly into the intermodal volume in a lot of those lanes that I was just showing, the LA to Chicago and LA to Dallas corridor. So it seems like there's going to be capacity in the ocean market, you know, coming online. Henry talks in that article also about how the ocean tender rejection rates have increased and how he thinks that's temporary, you know, as a result of those carriers pulling capacity out of their networks by, you know, blank sailings and other methods. You know, very interesting how he came to those conclusions. But, you know, all of this, I think, sort of translates to there's going to be, you know, excess capacity for shippers on the ocean, and that's going to translate into excess capacity on the intermodal networks and also the domestic, you know, truckload networks. You know, even though we're seeing, you know, truckload capacity come out of the marketplace, not coming out quite fast enough to at least immediately tighten up the truckload market. It's going to be a period of time before that is tighter, although, you know, things could be very different, you know, let's say middle part of next year.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting because, Donnie Gilbert got in touch with me last week after I had published that story on grain exports, that Q&A. And, you know, and he had mentioned, he had pointed me to a similar chart on intermodal rates, as a way of showing that, you know, that the rates have dropped, in order sort of to encourage, more business essentially, which is kind of what the grain export, kind of how that ties the grain export article. That's because, you know, the grain exports have, and if you actually, getting ahead of myself, the grain exports have grain volumes, I should say, grain volumes, grain carloads have actually dropped quite a bit year to date. I don't have the figure in front of me, but, you know, I was just looking at it. You know, they've declined by a double digit percentage year to date. So, and so you have, you know, the railroads kind of eager to you know, to get more business, and that's kind of how, you know, you tied it with the intermodal. You know, trying to drum up just more business in general with the rate. So yeah. And actually, you know, what you said too about the industrial outlook, you know, AAR released its, I think today's Thursday. Yesterday, they put out sort of the August volumes, and, you know, they had a quote from their senior economist there saying, you know, that kind of confirming what you said, which is, you know, even though, you know, automotive volumes have been pretty strong this year for the class one railroads in the U.S., you know, the industrial, you can kind of see, I think it was a carload on a monthly basis, year-to-year comparison. It's a third consecutive, so August was a third consecutive month that carloads have fallen year over year. So, and again, pointing to the industrial situation, or the lower sort of industrial output. So,
yeah, I mean, carloads almost always go the same direction as industrial production. So that's really, I think what you're saying, I think that's right. Hope everyone found that helpful. If anyone has any feedback, always can email us. But hope that's all we have for today. Hope everyone has a great day.